blacks really don't know where they stand in certain situations. And I think it's imperative that blacks know where they stand, period. I think there should be one person in all situations. I don't think a black has to change his color dependent on the situation in which he is in, the situation where he's living, the situation where he's working. I think as soon as blacks learn to believe in themselves as not merely black people standing up for a cause, but as people who want to live like any other people, they will be better off.
This is Andromeda 21, a series of conversations, rap sessions, with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Culture Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. The purpose of these programs is to inform and inspire, to spread the realization that black is beautiful. The title of this program refers to the Ethiopian princess Andromeda, who, like us, was in chains, became free, and later took her place among the stars.
I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
My guest today is Mr. Burley Hines, Jr., the urban affairs correspondent with WBBM Radio, the CBS affiliate in Chicago. Mr. Hines spoke on our campus about the struggle for identity and had some very, very interesting tests for his own black identity before and after his lecture. Could you tell us about that, Burley?
Well, after the speech, Hank, I was invited over to the Afro-American Culture Center. And over there, I met quite a few fellas who persisted in telling me that my identification as I had talked about it in my speech of the black man, was entirely wrong. I had mentioned in my speech that I thought Marcus Garvey, one of our old-time leaders, in his efforts to get black people to leave this country and go back to Africa, was dead wrong. I thought he should have concentrated his efforts on making the home base here in America, but doing something toward establishing the black man's identity right here. Well, they told me in no uncertain terms that they didn't see it this way, and that ultra-black militants, I mean the militants who even go beyond the fist-waving brand of militancy, had told them, and this is what they had believed, that it would have been better off, Negroes would have been better off if they had left this country and made for themselves an island from which they could be self-serving, and nobody else had better lay a hand on this island. So we had quite a, maybe 2 hours of pretty strong conversation about who was right and who was wrong.
One of the concepts here by the militants is this, and it's very beautifully phrased. They say, we would like to build a black island in a sea of whiteness on this campus.
Now, that's what, that's what one of the kids told me. He said, we would want a government within a government. Well, I said, that wouldn't be any good if the government that was over your government was more powerful than your government. What would stop them from, if they felt like it, just crushing it? They said, well, no, that's not what we want. I said, well, what would you want? How would you do that in the United States? And they said, well, the black Muslims have done it. I said, well, the black Muslims have their own character about them, and they don't really have a government within a government. They're sort of spread out. They're not in exactly one place. They said, well, Marcus Garvey had the right idea.
Well, you mentioned at the end of your speech last night black chauvinists, and how would you characterize them and maybe give examples of the chauvinists you saw last night?
I mentioned black chauvinism in the specter of certain black militant leaders, whom I would call overly militant leaders. These are the black fire eaters who think that their way is the only way. And these kind of people I just don't like at all. These are the people who stand up in front of a crowd, and if you don't raise your fist when they raise their fist, they don't like it. These are the people who say, if you are not with me, you are my enemy. You cannot have your own style. You must be as I am, because I am the way, the truth, and the light, and through me you shall be free. Well, I don't like these kind of people, and I tell them so.
And you call them demagogues.
I call them demagogues. Yes, I do. I may not be able to leave here alive, but I call them demagogues.
And let's look at it from another point of view. What would these people, these college kids, be characterized as if they were on 63rd Street in the heart of the ghetto?
If they were on 63rd Street in the heart of the ghetto, they would be run out immediately. Because some of them, to me, have no real formal touch with the really poor people in the ghetto. These poor people in the ghetto aren't standing on the corners howling, you know, black power, right on, man. They are too busy trying to make it. They are struggling day and night, working two and three jobs trying to do it. And the only thing they want to hear is, man, what can you help me do to live? What can you help me do to get by? And, you know, coming up there talking about moving to Africa, they can't even move to the next block. And this is what they want to find out. How can you better their situation? But don't tell them about leading them on a march downtown to City Hall or leading them on a march to another country. They won't hear it.
You mentioned, too, I believe, that they are really people who have faith in America. Is that right?
They very strongly have faith in America. They know that this country, they believe this country is the best country in the world. Nowhere else could they have even the opportunity to live where they are living and still go to some place and listen to these nuts, some of these nuts who are trying to tell them how to get out of it. So most of the things they don't understand, because only some of these leaders only understand what they're saying themselves, and they don't project it to the other people. But I think that violence for violence' sake, let's say, has no place in the civil rights movement. I don't like inflicting pain on other people just to further my own, just to satisfy my own bitterness. And that's what I was talking about last night.
Yeah, it seems, ironically, that the kind of chauvinists you described really themselves comprise a very small fraction of the college student body. There's a black student body. Is that right?
That is true. At the Culture Center last night, I only met two or three young fellows who seemed to exhibit this type of determination. But the bad thing about this is these are the type of people who get all of the play. The other people are sort of the person who has his own style, a less militant style, we'll say, a less aggressive style, he's shoved into a corner and is afraid to talk because he's afraid he's going to get his throat cut if he does. And that's what I don't like. I like everybody to stand up and voice their views. For all you know, there may be other people who are less militant who may have a better way of doing things. And I want to hear from those people.
I want to hear more from you, but we had to get that out because it happens all over the country, wherever you go. You're challenged when you're out doing your thing
right.
in the audience.
Right.
A guy said,
right.
What are you doing? I wanted to jump up and say, well, look, he's writing every day, man. He's talking.
Right, right.
So it's a test of your manhood, I believe.
It's exactly what it was last night.
I think you were more than up to it in that you didn't hide behind middle-class etiquette
and
take it.
Oh, my God, no. I am as middle-class as anybody. I've got a job which a lot of people think would make me an Oreo cookie. That is black on the outside, white on the inside. Well, I have been ordered out of black militants' office because I have expressed my view. But sooner or later, through my reporting, I report what they have to say, but I also balance it off with report that other blacks have to say, not the more militant blacks, but the more moderate blacks. And as I said before, you need all of these voices, and I think I've gained quite a bit of respect for being objective as I can be, being black, with what's going on in the country today. But I think I've gotten along pretty well. I haven't been shot yet.
Seems that identity really is perhaps one of the most crucial problems for blacks. So how would you define the problem?
Blacks really don't know where they stand in certain situations. And I think it's imperative that blacks know where they stand, period. I think there should be one person in all situations. I don't think a black has to change his color dependent on the situation in which he is in, the situation where he's living, the situation where he's working. I think as soon as blacks learn to believe in themselves as not merely black people standing up for our cause, but as people who want to live like any other people, they will be better off. And this identity crisis, as I said last night in the speech, is something that we're going through now. You see it in the Naturals, in the Damn Shikis, as a certain writer says, and you see it in the predilection to wear certain types of clothes, such as the dashiki. And I think this is very good for the black. I think this is a period that should have come long ago. And I think through this period, out of this period, we may evolve into a period where we begin to accept ourselves more. At least we're doing that right now. Beginning to trust each other. Beginning to love each other. You know, once upon a time, the worst businesses in the black communities were the black businesses who established themselves there to be frequented by black people. Now, the black people in those communities would bypass their own businesses to go downtown and shop with the white stores. And you ask them why. I don't trust those people. You know, the whites have better stuff. Now, we're beginning to frequent our own businesses, and we begin to patronize our own stores, and this is very good. We're beginning to trust each other.
You mentioned the quotation from William James, which would indicate to a person when he knew he had achieved his own identity. Could you explain that for me, please?
Yes, William James said that a person realizes his own identity when, in a given situation, he can say to himself, as he's pursuing a certain venture, this is the real me. This is me. And with that, he can feel inside of him an active tension that lets him know he is at home with himself. And I explained that certain athletes feel this way when they make a shot, a good shot on the floor, and they feel they're working up to their potential, and they feel they are somebody, and they know that, well, heck, I am good. Well, look, I've got an identity. Look what I can do. And this is what William James was talking about all along. I said, most blacks can't feel that right now because they're facing a continual battle within themselves.
I'm glad to hear you say that, man, because I often think that if you have to shout loud every day that black is beautiful, you don't believe it.
Incredibly wrong. No, if you know inside your heart, without even having to say a word, that you are all right, that you are somebody, you've got your identity, and you don't have to worry about any flamethrower coming towards you.
And same way with the black woman. If she really believes she's beautiful, why does she have to be threatened if she sees somebody, a brother with a blonde?
Oh, God. This is really funny. That happened to me last night. One of the young ladies who came down here with me happens to be white, and we were sitting in the culture center. And one of the questions raised was, did I think that the black man had come full cycle because in certain riot-torn areas, they are coming back to the bars with their white girlfriends?
Wow.
And she said she had read this in the New York Times and the Washington Post. Well, I had never read anything like this, and I don't know whether she's read anything like this. But anyhow, it was a slap, it was a dig, and I don't know where she was coming from, but somewhere out in left field.
How'd you answer that?
I didn't answer it. I went on to the next question.
Yeah, what we would like on the show is complete honesty, and honesty dictates that identity comes from within, and if you've got it, you don't
darn
have to be
right.
threatened.
You're
this
darn,
is what kills
that's
me.
That's it. I feel sorry for the black man in the middle who really doesn't know where he is going or where he stands. I feel particularly sorry for the black middle-class man and the black middle-class women because they feel sort of hurt. They feel guilty because they are doing well, and the black militants are saying, if you are not helping your brother, then you are not really free. And here he is. He's living in a nice house. He's doing everything he can to make it. And he feels that he's done quite a bit in his lifetime. Now he's struggled, just like the black militant is struggling out there on the street to get people to follow him. And the black militant wants to tear down his house, assassinate the more moderate leaders. And I feel this is terribly wrong. I think the black middle class is beginning to do quite a bit as far as opening his pocketbook. Angela Davis is a case. I happen to know that a lot of people have contributed to the Angela case, the Angela Davis's defense in California, not knowing Angela Davis and not really caring for communism. And that's a hell of a change in this day and age. And I think it's all a part of the black awareness bag, and I think it's very good.
The Black Awareness Bag. Now, you trace the evolution of the civil rights movement to the point where we have a new thing called the Black Awareness Bag. Could you tell us what that is, and I believe in so doing, say, what happened to the civil rights movement?
That's it's so simple that it's, I guess it's really hard to understand. But during the era of the sit-ins and the pray-ins and the fly-ins and the wait-ins and what have you, blacks were in these movements, but they were working in an integrated effort with white people. And all of a sudden, the blacks decided that they would take over these movements themselves. They had been led, the movement had been spurred by white kids coming from the north going down south. The blacks all of a sudden wanted positions of leadership. And this really perplexed the whites, who thought that they were there to give leadership and to lend inspiration to these people to show them that they were on their side. There were some whites who were sympathetic to them, laying their heads on the line. But when the blacks wanted to take over the leadership positions, the whites did not understand. It was the old case of paternalism coming straight to the forefront. We are here to take care of you, baby, so, you know, and we'll take some of the shocks if necessary. So the whites got out. When people like Stokely started shouting black power and whites should get out of these organizations, blacks should take them over. That led into the period of confrontation between black brother and white brother. Most of the whites scurried to the hills because they just couldn't understand it. They withdrew their money and they withdrew their support. And out of that, blacks began to look at each other. And this, in turn, led to the Black Awareness Bag. They began feeling, well, we're not so bad after all. If we're going to have to stick together, we might as well trust each other. And then that's when you saw probably the first dashiki. In between this, you had the urban riots, because when the whites moved out and nothing was really done after the sit-ins, as far as the large cities were concerned, the people went crazy in the streets, although it was not planned. It was a spontaneous evolution of a lot of bitter feelings in the inner core. People probably who had never marched in a civil rights march. But these people were tired. They were the have-nots fighting the haves, the merchants who had been discriminated against them, digging at them, taking every penny they had and in crazy mixed-up deals with furniture and clothes and whiskey and what have you.
Now, this is a world that the middle-class white audience simply has no idea
that
it exists.
Right. This moving about of blacks in the inner city, this manipulation of blacks in the inner city by certain unscrupulous merchants for their own benefit, people who have no contact, merchants who have no contact with the inner city.
And what would you say their profits are, the average profit margin is with merchants in the ghetto?
Oh, my God, it must be more than 90%. You know, you spend 2 cents for something and sell it for a dollar. And the people have to depend on these people because they can't go anywhere. They haven't even got the car fare to go out of the community to go to another store. And these people feed on these people, and they make themselves rich doing it.
And even more, I think they're afraid to go to the store. I understand there are adults on the west side of Chicago who've never been to the Loop.
There are adults on the west side of Chicago who think that the west side of Chicago is all there is to Chicago. They think that that Negroes are in the majority in the city. They haven't seen that many whites. There are school kids on the south side of Chicago who think there are more blacks in Chicago than there are whites. They are little bitty kids who walk up to you and say, you know, it's just like a black going to an all-white neighborhood, a white neighborhood that's been all-white for a lot of years, and people who've never seen blacks, such as some areas up in Canada. You go through, a black will go through, and they look at him like he's crazy. Well, a white will come through these neighborhoods, and some of these kids have never seen whites in their lives. They've been going to all-black schools, all-black churches, all-black shows. They've never been out of that one perimeter.
And yet this is the north, this is Chicago,
This is
right?
Chicago, right on the south side, less than a mile from City Hall.
Dig it, and they talk about Mississippi.
Oh, God. And some of them sound like they live in Mississippi. They have been nurtured by parents who have come from the south and they live in those vertical prisons over there that they call housing projects, right over from 28th and State Street all the way up to 55th and State Street. You've got over 100,000 people who live in virtual prisons. Those buildings go up as high as 18 floors, and those people very rarely get out of the neighborhood. Their life is their children and perhaps a TV set that they have bought secondhand, which the welfare people don't want them to have, and they have to hide when the caseworker comes.
Yeah, one of my friends estimates that their travel pattern is very restrictive,
very
restrictive, roughly to an area of like 16 blocks.
That's right. Right in that little area, in that little concentration camp, it's just a horrible way to exist because you can't call it living.
And again, we'll get back to the chauvinists. How close could the chauvinists reach people like this?
I have not seen nor heard of any black so-called leader visiting this area. These people don't know what a civil rights movement is. And I think it's because these people have nothing to contribute to a civil rights movement as far as money is concerned. And therefore, these people, these so-called leaders, there are some good leaders, but these militant leaders, I call them, have never been inside these ghetto places. And I know because I have. I go over there quite frequently and talk to these people. These people form their own little tenant unions and do what they can within themselves and within their own perimeter. But as far as civil rights leaders, you talk to these people about civil rights leaders, they'll break your head because they have done nothing for them.
So the impetus of the black awareness bag on the whole is very, very good. Is that
very, very good? Yeah, I love to see the little kids walking around with their little dashikis on and their hair in the natural style and saying, "Black is good, baby." That's very inspiring, and it's very good because if you want this awareness thing to be successful, you have to start it young. And I think the parents have to realize that black is not all bad, as we've been told all our lives, that you can trust black people, that they are not inherently inferior, and that they can make good in the world.
And about black history courses themselves in relation to all this, who should they be for?
By all means, they should be for white people. I think black history courses are most important when they are instituted in the regular history courses of a given school. If they're taught right on, they have to be taught right alongside American history because blacks are a part of American history. As I said in my speech last night, it would be nice if we could finally come to the day when we didn't have to have a special ethnic history course written and lived by any special ethnic group. If we could have all of our history in one history and we could live it and learn it in peace as Americans all, because that's what we all are, Americans.
Well, geez, Burley, I could go on for days about this, but you've hit the problem on the head, and as a newsman, I'd ask, how do you solve this problem when you have a fringe of black leaders, maybe one half of 1%, who are doing their thing and get the news coverage, and it's so different from what the masses stand for? How do you solve this, man?
As newsmen, Hank, you and I, we cannot hope to solve it. All we can hope to do is give inspiration to the more reasoned voices to come forth. If they are going to have to shout to get themselves heard, they are going to have to shout to get themselves heard. Because I feel somewhere in these voices that we are not hearing, there is a solution to all of these problems. And I'm talking about black as well as white. We have these white Minutemen as well as we have these black Mau Mau. And I think both of these leadership elements should come forward no matter how much shouting or cutting down it takes and tell us what's on their mind. Because only then will we be able to sort of coagulate all of these movements into something that will bring us to a racial dilemma solution.
It seems that most black people in this country are religious, docile, and patriotic.
That's it. That's the reason the more militant leaders have gained the foothold and gained the press. And that's what I was talking about. They're going to have to get off this docility bit because that's in the past. Otherwise, they're going to be hurt more than anybody else because we're outgunned out there. We haven't got the troops to fight an all-out war. And I'm afraid that when these young blacks come back from Vietnam, what there are that are left of them that don't die over there, and Vietnam is over, and the thrust of concentration from Washington becomes on the cities, we may have a return to the long, hot summers, because the young people will not be thinking about how to get out of going to the army. they'll be thinking of how to get out of staying in that ghetto, and it'll be really fiery.
So time is running out for us.
Time is really running out for us. As Nixon widens down the war in the ghetto is going to become more bombastic, and it's going to be something if somebody does not come up with some alternatives.
And some of us are going to have to get out there and denounce the fringe.
That's right.
And try to help the
people.
That is
so true. That's what the whole thing is about. We're going to have some voices, some reasoning voices, rather than these unreasoning voices coming forth with crazy demands that nobody can meet.
The paradox of it all is that these guys themselves haven't achieved black identity.
That's it. They are shouting for their own manhood, a manhood that they don't realize they could have if they would just sit down and think about it for a few minutes. You know, they are people. They were born men. They are somebody. As Reverend Jesse Jackson says every Saturday, we are somebody. We may be in jail, but we are somebody.
Well, to paraphrase James again, one knows when he has achieved identity when a voice inside says, this is really me.
This is the real me.
And this is a message we hope we can get to all black people in this country. So thank you very much, Burley, for being my guest. It's been very, very exciting.
Thank you, Hank.
My guest today is Mr. Burley Hines, Jr., the urban affairs correspondent with WBBM Radio, the CBS affiliate in Chicago.
This has been Andromeda 21, another in the series of conversations with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Culture Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. Your host for this series is Hank Parker, instructor in the Department of Classics at the University of Illinois.
All the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. To be me, then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
Andromeda 21 was produced and directed by Louise Geislers for WILL, the radio service of the University of Illinois in Urbana.
Like I'm longing to live, I wish I could do. Sing, hang, 'cause I